You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Nikita.
Hey, Bob. How are you doing?
Oh, I couldn't be better. And yourself?
I'm pretty good. I came back from what appears to become an annual ritual of a pilgrimage to ancient oracular sites in Greece. So I'm kind of one foot still in a dream world. But we're going to talk about the grim realities of the waking reality, the waking world.
Also, remind me, I have a kind of connection between your little whatever that thing you just did in Greece is, and I really do. This is a profound connection I'm going to make. And One of the things we're going to discuss, which is the papal encyclical on artificial intelligence. In fact, we're going to kind of lead with that, but there's a couple of other things we're going to discuss, and I should mention those. First, there's this thing that either is a peace deal in the Iran war that is, or at least an extension of the ceasefire that either is going to happen or is collapsing as we speak, depending on which kind of news feed you're focused on. And I have some things to say about that, but precisely because it's too fluid, I don't think we want to start off with that, because it could be that everything we said would be totally irrelevant by the time we stop recording. And then there's this thing you're hearing more and more about with respect to Russia-Ukraine war, which is the possibility of it spilling over into Western Europe. There's been more talk of that in the last 2 or 3 weeks. If that happened, spilling over would be too mild a term, of course. But there's that. And that is owing ultimately to some technological developments in the art of war. And those in turn are kind of tied to this papal encyclical about AI. So when you think about it, it all ties together. And speaking of AI, as you know, the Non-Zero Discord, which you're more conversant in than I am, but I'm about to become more conversant because I'm going to be spending a little more time there. Anyway, that is, we're about to, what is the term? Is unveiled too strong a term? We're going to have a more concerted focus on AI as a discussion topic. Not the only discussion topic. You can always go there and discuss whatever you want. But we want to talk about that. And actually, we're going to have a kind of a mystery guest at the end of the public part of this podcast, who is also going to be part of the Discord revival or whatever, renaissance. What did I miss, Nikita, before we dive into the news of the
I think all of that sounds right. Yeah. Should we say more about who the mystery guest is?
I don't know. Well, we can't keep calling him a mystery guest if we do, Nikita. I mean, let's think about this. You know, this is a bridge. Once you cross this bridge, okay? Once you build something as a mystery, and by the way, this is the word that connects the papal encyclical to your little... Did they talk about the mystery religions in your little thing?
That's the whole thing.
Well, okay. That's what I'm saying. This all ties together.
Does the Pope use the word mystery in the...
Well, it's a big word in Catholicism, actually. It's, I think, a word Paul uses that Catholics focus on more than Protestants. And then it's used by the Anthropic guy, who I gather showed up somehow. Mm-hmm. Anthropic managed to, get a seat at the table. I think this guy was, like, physically there. And he used the word mystery in a way I can get into. But maybe with that as a backdrop, I think I just definitely took care of your suggestion that we mention the person, didn't I? The mystery guest? Do you feel outmaneuvered?
I do. I'm okay with that. I'm fine with that.
Oh, no, I'll leave it up to you. You're like, you know, you young people every once in a while.
Well, so the reason the Mr. Guest is important is he's going to be a part of this Discord revival. He is, should we not call him by name to remain the mysterious heir?
Well, we'll just...
But he's tied to an AI-related activist operation.
he is. And we can say his first name is Jeremy because, as Jeremy and I discuss in the conversation with him that you're going to see part of, you know, the prophet Jeremy is, he doesn't always see that the glass is half full. And like AI safety advocates, does not always see the glass half full. In fact, the term Jeremiad derives from the prophet Jeremy in the Bible. So, yeah, it's all coming together here. So, yeah, the papal encyclical. Now, you and I, right before we started taping, asked some AIs, like, how often has a pope? I mean, we figured, like, look, the whole encyclical is on AI. It's super long. Why would you read it instead of just ask AIs about it? It seems like the perfect occasion for substituting AIs for the things that we used to cherish in humans.
I wonder if the encyclical itself has a chapter on how you should not do that.
I think he literally said we should use AI to substitute it for all the things in humans we used to cherish. That is the drift. No, I'm kidding. That's the opposite of the drift, obviously. But anyway, you and I were pressed for time. So we did rely unduly on AI. And we said, like, how often in the entire history of the Roman Catholic Church has there been an encyclical on technology? So far, we have not come up with an example of one. Now, I'm guessing in a weird way, probably something on birth control is the closest, because it has to do with, you know, medical technology, abortion. I mean, look, any birth control device, even the most primitive, is a technology. And now, of course, we have the pill. So anyway,
that technology apparently has been a theme that is brought up and woven into other topics, but in more generic terms than this. This is like, let's look at this development that seems to be changing a lot of things in our life and in directions that are hard to predict. And a lot of them are troubling for the Pope.
Mm-hmm. They are. And so I would divide his things and his key points or most publicized points into two categories. One is kind of the practical. And here I think he's focusing on definitely some of the right things. I mean, distribution of power is one. Now this part is an AI summary, but I think a reliable one. Where is it? He apparently casts it as, in a way, part of a broader technological issue, which is just kind of algorithms generally, to some extent. Anyway, the AI summary is: local communities, families, and schools must be protected from opaque, top-down, algorithmic governance. Decisions affecting human lives must remain transparent and contestable. That really is a good way to put it, I think. And, you know, there's a danger of that not happening, not just because we don't know exactly what's going on in the machines. That's a separate thing. But these AI companies don't disclose anything to us. I mean, because the government doesn't make them and they don't want to. They don't tell us what the training text is. And other, you know, various things. That's certainly a valid concern. Now, here is an actual quote from the thing, from the encyclical. The apparent objectivity of the responses and suggestions these systems provide can lead us to overlook the fact that they reflect the cultural assumptions of those who design and train them with all their strengths and limitations. Now, some people are taking this as too woke because they're thinking about, you know, the time like Google and trying to compensate for this overcompensated and gave us pictures of black Vikings and stuff. But, you know, first of all, I think concerns in that realm, you know, racial bias, gender, whatever, are legitimate, but also it goes well beyond that. I mean, you know, you're talking about the potential of people who control these machines, if indeed control is centralized. And I think that's one thing maybe this at least implicitly warns against. being able to use them to, you know, marshal jingoistic, nationalistic sentiments that are put to belligerent use and so on. So bias, very broadly speaking, is an issue. And as you know, Nikita, I have a book on AI called The God Test coming out in a few weeks. And, you know, one thing I emphasize in there is how hard it is, how almost inevitable the bias is, how hard it is to discern, and how hard we have to work to make sure that it doesn't overwhelm us. So
the bias is not going to show up just in like image generation of Vikings or whatnot.
Oh, God, no.
One of the big parts of this encyclical, from what I should say, it does look like a very interesting text, and it's lengthy. It's 5 chapters and a conclusion, and I want to give it proper treatment, and maybe we'll return to it after we both do that. But even from glancing at the text and like reading other people's and AI summaries, war is one of the big topics.
Yeah.
And he says that the just war theory is outdated. He emphasizes that self-defense is the one kind of justification. The war should only be fought as last resort. And he worries about AI making decisions in war. And those decisions, who's responsible for these decisions? If the machine, I mean, if there is already a war, there are issues like targeting and like that school that was bombed in Iran.
Right.
I think there are, I don't know if we know for sure, but I've seen pieces arguing that that was a machine-made decision. Who's going to bear responsibility?
I would guess that the problem there was that they failed to do something they could have done. I do think AI played a role. I think the chances are high that the Palantir orchestrated system called, I think, Maven or something, that does use Claude, Anthropic's Claude, was used. So I think in that sense, Claude played a role. I think the biggest mistake was not to do something they could have done with AI, which is really critically evaluate the existing target list. I doubt the AI came up with that target. It was probably from an old map or something. But if AI, you know, I don't know, what better use for it than to critically evaluate the existing target list and say, wait a second. So anyway, so when the Pope talks about, you know, declining accountability for carnage and using AI as a kind of screen for that. I mean, the targeting issue is certainly a good example. You know, people have, this magazine 972 for years has been writing about the role of AI targeting in Gaza and how, and, you know, it just lets you say, well, you know, we didn't tell it to kill, you know, what we now see as an unarmed 15-year-old male. No, you didn't tell it. But in the end, the criteria it had amounted to killing pretty much all young males, right? That's the allegation. And I don't think, I mean, young beyond a certain age. I don't mean 9 years old. But so anyway, these are all, he's hitting good issues on the practical side. And then he raises the metaphysical issue where he says that, you know, you got to remember, this is just silicon, basically. It'll never, you know,
it doesn't have experiences.
Right. And he thinks it's important that, you know, of course that's contestable. We can get into that, but the,
and he doesn't have a body, which of course you can build one.
What's that?
He says the AI doesn't have a body, which is important, but of course you can build one.
Yeah. Yeah. That is destined, I think, not to look great in retrospect once, robots are doing the masses, you know, masses in the sense of Catholic mass. I don't mean leaving
Have you seen there's a Buddhist robot now? There's an actual monk that's a robot.
Yeah. I'm not shocked. I mean, that's a stunt I would have pulled if I had thought of it first. You know.
I mean, in Buddhism, with its doctrine of emptiness, I think it lends itself easier to playing with AI than Catholicism.
Actually, No, but that's another story. I have a chapter on emptiness in my Buddhism book. anyway, where were we? So the Pope is worried about people jumping to this, what he considers a facile conclusion, that this is kind of real life. So here he writes, and this again is from the thing. His actual words, the artificial limitation of positive human communication, words of advice, empathy, friendship, and even love can be engaging and at times genuinely helpful. Okay, so that's good. I mean, we have to recognize that in some cases it will be. However, he goes on, for less discerning users, it can also be misleading, creating the illusion of a relationship with a real personal subject. And of course, there are cases of, you know, suicide by teens who were under that illusion. Max Tegmark, who's been on the podcast and is a big safety advocate, professor at MIT, he seized on something the Pope said basically to justify the pause movement, which is, by the way, that's another clue about our mystery guest, that word, the AI pause movement. But the Pope said, and Max quotes him, quote, humanity in all its grandeur and woundedness must never be replaced or surpassed. So, you know, Max is saying, oh, if you're serious about
that's
that.
That's Max or the Pope?
That's the Pope. That's Max the Pope. Is tweeting saying, what he says is, although Pope Leo the 14th encyclical doesn't explicitly mention the superintelligence that AI companies say they're racing toward, its opposition to it in favor of controllable AI tools is clear. One of his talking points, Max Tegmark's, is that we should distinguish between what he calls controllable AI tools, like build a tool to cure cancer, fine, and the truly general purpose things that he thinks threaten to get out of control. So I was kind of wrong. Max isn't enlisting him in the service of pause per se, although I think Max is in favor of a concerted slowdown, to say the least, while we figure this thing out. But he's using it in favor of this distinction, you know, between something that could become true superintelligence and things that will remain tools we can use. So
what do you think the consequences of this particular document could be? And do you expect other things like that? Like, I've been waiting for the Pope and, you know, Buddhist teachers, and like, it seems like religious and philosophical movements should really grapple with this, and there should be a Buddhist position on it and a Catholic position on it and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you think the consequence of this would be, if any? I mean, is it going to affect policy? Is it going to affect how companies navigate this, how governments navigate this?
Well, I think it will certainly, I mean, religions will obviously more and more grapple with it. I mean, I think that you will see, just as you've seen apps, you know, meditation apps, mm-hmm. and, you know, there are what you could call Catholic apps out there, not necessarily put out by the Catholic Church, right? But put out by somebody.
I've got a Catholic app on my phone to navigate the city when they're doing the Holy Week. There's like a dedicated app for the routes of the procedures.
There you go. I mean, what I think is that you're going to get two things. Existing spiritual religious movements may in some cases start saying, okay, this AI model has our seal of approval. Like it exerts what we think is a positive influence on the worldview of the person using it. And we encourage people, you know, in our tribe to use it. I think you may see that. And then you'll see totally new things spring up that say, you know, we want to, and I can think of some things I would like to encourage, and I get into them in my book, and I think we should use AI very purposefully to try to encourage them. And some of those consist partly of strengthening our ability to resist the influence of the nefarious influence of AI. But I think you're going to see that. I doubt there will be an official Catholic AI, but who knows? I do think religious leaders will, in some cases, give their seal of approval to like AI friends or assistants that they say embody their values.
So that's like a step from a priest. There would be a disclaimer at the top. You should actually go see a priest and be a part of your Catholic community. But when you can't, here's our auto-response bot that knows.
Yeah, I mean, the traditional religions will want that disclaimer. Whether all the new ones will is another question. But if they don't, that may be a warning sign. It's going to get so wild. I'm sorry. I hate to break this to people who still don't think it's going to get wild.
I think it's already pretty wild.
Yeah.
Should I segue to Ukraine, Russia, Ukraine, because there's drones involved there?
Yeah, let me see if there's anything else. I think that's a good idea. I would just say, so the Anthropic guy, the mystery thing, I should quickly touch on that. The Anthropic guy, who's an interpretability researcher and was actually part of, I guess, the presentation, part of some, I don't know, panel accompanying it or something. Anyway, he had some quasi-official status, I think. And his name is Chris Ola. He looks like he's about 12, which at my age is a compliment. I would rather look 12 than how I look. But he's actually like 35 or something. And he's an interpretability researcher, which means he tries to figure out what's going on inside the machines. And Anthropic, I would say, of the big three, has at least more conspicuous work that we know about on this front than the other two. They've done some interesting stuff. And here's what he says. It's a very short statement he gives. But he says, this is maybe a third of it. I am a scientist. I lead a research team that studies the internal structure of these models, what is actually happening inside them. And I will be honest, we keep finding things that are mysterious, even unsettling. We find structures that mirror results from human neuroscience. We find evidence of introspection. We find internal states that functionally mirror joy, satisfaction, fear, grief, and unease. I don't know what that means, but I think it warrants ongoing discernment. Now, what's your initial reaction to that?
I like the sound of that. I think that's the territory we should be exploring.
Yeah, it's. I thought mysterious was interesting. Unless this guy like has a Catholic background, he may not know what a prominent word that can be in Catholic discourse. As I understand it, I'm sure there are different strands of Catholic discourse, but the mystery. You know, Paul uses that term. And this is actually, I think, related to Catholicism's relative friendliness to science compared to at least some Protestant denominations. I think, you know, Catholicism does not deny that evolution happened, for example, and maybe a dwindling number of Protestant religions do. But 50 years ago, I had just been brought up in one that did deny evolution. And part of that, you know, the word mystery comes in handy because it's, I think, a kind of testament to your inability to comprehend divinity and the works of divinity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, yeah. Evolution happened. It's like, I don't know, you want to pin me down on exactly how it relates to Genesis? I don't know. And I think that kind of humility is in order when you're trying to answer the kinds of questions that religions try to answer. But my insufficiently informed sense is that that's one of the ways the word mystery functions. The The one thing I would say is I'm not sure it was wise of him to say we find evidence of introspection. I think to a lot of people that will mean, and I don't think, maybe he does mean it this way, subjective experience.
I think what he's talking about is when they try to, I forget what it's called now, in Anthropic's products, they have this layer now of trying to kind of see the speech of the machine for itself, sort of like its internal thinking process. And I think there are, what would you call them? You don't want to call them emotions because it presupposes an experience, but emotion-like narratives that lead to different conclusions. So the mechanics uses the language that we associate with human internal experiences. And as a good engineer, you shouldn't assume there's anything behind those words, but the words are there. The machine may say that it's feeling uneasy about something, let's say.
Right. I mean, they do talk about themselves as things. And they do refer to, they use words that we use to refer to subjective states. Now, of course, they were trained on human text. So that may not mean they have the subjective states. We just don't know. And it's very, in principle, very hard to, well, it's in principle impossible to know for sure that any being other than yourself has subjective experience. But the anyway, I'm just saying, I think he uses language that makes it too easy for people to misunderstand him as saying they have subjective experience. I would have spent more time on this section. And then he says, we find internal states that functionally mirror joy, satisfaction, fear, grief, and unease. I assume what he means there is that whenever they're acting joyful or talking about feeling joy, there's a certain pattern of neuronal activation or something. You know, that's interesting if true, but it shouldn't be confused with what some people may think he's saying.
Did the Pope have any response to this?
I don't think the Pope responded to this, no. I mean, look, they're giving this guy, you know, I mean, you know, you can only ask for so much in this world, you know. You can go to the Pope's party, but you can't be like the host. So anyway, you know more about Russia than I do by a long shot. And what's the story there?
Yeah, well, the reason it's on my mind now is, well, I mean, it's on my mind now because things are happening. Russia is experiencing more and more, as I think we've talked about last time, drone attacks inside the country, not just on the front line. And while I was in Greece on my little pilgrimages, I don't like your use of word little there. It seems condescending. But when I was on that pilgrimage, my hometown, Moscow, and the hometown that's kind of administratively part of Moscow experienced the biggest, I think, wave of drone attacks since the beginning of the war. So that's why it's on my mind. You know, I called my mother in the morning. She's like, what, do you want to know whether I'm alive or not? Because everybody's calling. Everybody's on the phone. And so I'm reading more about it, but what I'm thinking about today is I was reading up and listening to these podcasts on the logistics of what they're calling the kill zone, which is the front line. There are varying accounts on how wide this line is, but it's basically the 10 kilometers, let's say, in each direction from the front line is just very well covered by drones observing the territory, which changes the dynamic of the battlefield.
It's how far they're saying?
I saw varying accounts. Yeah. Some say 10 kilometers in each direction, and it's widening, apparently. I don't know, and I'm sure
that's
it's not.
That's like 7 miles or something. Yeah, I've heard that it does vary from place to place.
Of course,
former General Petraeus said something about that. And this guy, Rob Lee, who's an expert guy, said, well, wait a second, and gave a counterexample. But in any event, the point is, this is a product of drone technology, right? This is new. In other words, there used to be these clean lines. Like you're holding, you know, you got this trench and you stay there for a really super long time. It's hard to overrun. But now those are even vulnerable to the attack of these little helicopter drones. And you're right. Saying, you know, well beyond that on both sides, it's an iffier proposition than it used to be.
My understanding, and I'm not a military expert, I listen to some and I try to retain the information, but it's fairly challenging for me. But my understanding of the main kind of consequence of this is there used to be a way you do this, and you gather your troops and you make a push with a formidable formation. You've got heavy equipment, vehicles, you put a lot of people together, you do an attack. And now it's kind of suicidal to even begin this, because if you gather and you've got these vehicles, that is a very easily observable target, and these drones will just show up and attack before you do anything. Mm-hmm. The reconnaissance is done differently. And so what that led to is lately, and I think it's been like at least a year of this, a move towards this, a shift towards this, that a lot of the fighting is done by very small groups of people. It's 2 people, 3 people, 5 people, 6 people that, and it gets ether here for me. I don't understand how common specific configurations are, specific ways of doing this, because I'm sure there is a variety of these. But the example that struck me is this expert that I was listening to on the Russian podcast compared it to a computer game where if you play the strategy game, you're observing the battlefield from atop, you've got your units and you control them, you tell them where to go. It's not exactly like that. It's not that the commander is looking at a screen and, you know, using his mouse to guide human soldiers to war.
We're getting there. We just but need it's a not few too more far electrode implantations in their brains. And but, you know, I hadn't even heard this part, the part that they are maintaining real-time reconnaissance, like of their own troops, of clusters of just a few troops. And what, they're giving them real-time guidance? Because they can also see further than the troops can see, right?
Right.
It's so I don't know how give them useful information and also then give them orders.
I don't know how like widespread it's definitely one of the modes of operation now. And of course it, you know, you rely on the radio to give the signals, to give the orders, and the other side is going to try to jam the radio signal. So there's on multiple layers, mm-hmm. there's this, you know, contest. But it is one of the modes. There's a drone up above observing the little group of human soldiers that are operating on their mission, and the commander is giving them orders on the radio, seeing them from above, from the camera in the drone. And that just made me think, surely this role, observing the troops from above and giving them directions, is soon going to be well performed by an AI. It may be better performed by a commander, in which case, instead of like, well, we have the drone, like, there's a human operator guiding the drone. That's a part of modern warfare now. Mm-hmm. You know, you're like playing a computer game, except that the vehicle that you're driving is in the real world and is going to blow up actual buildings or a trench or a vehicle. Mm-hmm. And then I think soon will be a reverse version of this where there are human soldiers getting orders from machine intelligence telling them where to go because it can process information quickly. If it's good at chess, why wouldn't it be bad at computer strategy games?
But it's an interesting question where the humans get replaced first, because eventually, presumably, the humans in the field will be robots. At least in some cases, it depends on a lot of things, the cost of the robots, the advantages they have. But shit, you can imagine some pretty like small robots that are harder to spot and kill and that can do a much better job of killing than people. So the question is, but that is, you know, that's a frontier of research that involves a lot of stuff not involved in getting the AI to a point where they can do what you're saying and be the commander back there making the decision. I mean, you'd expect both to happen eventually, but to me, it's an open question which happens first, because the commanding part, I'm trying to think how sophisticated the cognition has to be. Probably it won't be that long before that cognition is picking up on subtle cues that a human commander might overlook, given the same array of visual data, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, my guess would... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, just like, oh, this little thing over 200 yards away increases by 2% the chances that the enemy has done this.
Yeah.
And so that means that, you know, we should do a little more of this and a little less of that. That's the kind of thing. It's these fine grained probability things. That's, you know, one place where, you know, machine learning in principle has an advantage over us.
Yeah. My guess is there's going to be hybrids. My intuition is there's going to be robots and humans at both of these levels. There's, you know, you can't right now, you can't replace a human soldier, because a humanoid robot that can do all the things that a human can do is just not there yet. But Zelensky, not too long ago, made a whole address where he touted, I think, last year's sort of threshold, where he says that a particular position was taken over by the Ukrainian forces with no humans involved in the battlefield. So there were Russian soldiers in some, you know, I forget what it was, some building or whatever, and it was just the drones on the Ukrainian side that took the position.
Mm-hmm.
That's a threshold. Now, when I listened to commentary on this from these same experts, the guy said, yeah, that's not really news. That's been happening. And it doesn't sound as sci-fi if you've been following the war, because what it means is there are these, you know, three soldiers hidden someplace in some abandoned buildings. That's what the warfare is to a large extent now. As I said, these small groups trying to infiltrate the territory, find a place, hold out there, wait for further instructions when more such groups gather in that territory, and then maybe they can do a more of a coordinated effort. But for the time being, it's three of you and you're just holding this one position, and then a small helicopter like drone appears and you can't hide from them, and so you throw out the white flag and the drone leads you to surrender. So that's mm-hmm. not like one time that this happens. Zelensky made it this big threshold that's been crossed, but I think the both things are true, that this has been happening and that there is a certain kind of threshold, I think is true. And I think we're going to just see more of that. And on both levels, the person behind the computer, either guiding units, guiding humans, guiding robots in mm-hmm. the battlefield. And then in the battlefield, there will be humans and there will be robots.
Yeah, and then the other thing the drones have permitted in this war is these strikes deeper and deeper into Russian territory. And that's what, you know, we had talked about that in our last conversation, but that's what has led to this talk of Russia possibly choosing to expand the war, you know, kind of in retaliation. Now, I suspect that what's going on now is that Russia is trying to get this possibility on people's radar screens as a warning. You know, I first started hearing it on these podcasts where, you know, you get, there are these podcasts where there's kind of a fine line with some of the guests between just flat out pro-Russian bias and just more like an objective view that seems relatively Russian in orientation compared to the standard US MSM kind of pro-Ukraine view. So one guest on this kind of podcast, who I think does have evident pro-Russian kind of, well, bias in terms of presentation of information is Scott Ritter, leaving aside who he wants to win or whatever. And he has been emphasizing this, and some of them, but there have also been, you know, people considered a little more balanced in orientation than him who've been saying the same thing. Some of them are talking about nuclear, the possibility of a nuclear strike by Russia. I wouldn't imagine that happening anytime soon, but I do know that a few days ago, there was this headline, Russia holds nuclear drills on land, sea, and air, joined by its ally Belarus. I would think that was a clear signal. I don't know if it means anything, but I would think more likely if Russia wants to send a message. Because from Russia's point of view, right, it is suddenly vulnerable in this way. And it would say, look, we know that there's NATO intelligence going into this, these strikes, blah, blah, blah. I don't know if it's true, but I'm sure it's what they're assuming. And I think there's a pretty good chance it's true. So they're seeing this as a collective kind of NATO attack, or at least want to present it that way. And so the natural thing would be you retaliate against NATO allies to send the message you want it to stop. And so I would imagine the first actual step would be some kind of modest conventional attack on a Western European country, a target associated, you know, ideally maybe some, you don't kill anybody, but it's a target associated with a provision of intelligence to Ukraine. That would be my guess if this does start spilling over. But are you hearing stuff relevant to this in your circles?
So the thing that comes to mind that is the closest to it from the official Russian channels is, I think Lavrov, the foreign minister today, said that the Western ambassadors, diplomats in Kyiv should leave. Russia just yesterday, I think it was, launched this one of the bigger attacks and used for the third time, I think, used that Oreshnik missile. I think still not carrying any actual explosive. It's like a meteor or something falling from the sky.
This is a Russian missile?
It's a Russian missile that goes way faster than the sound barrier.
It's hypersonic, I'm sure, and it maneuvers, probably.
Yeah, and it's like has, I don't know, I've seen various reports on how important the technology behind it is, like how big of a game changer it is, but it's used as a threat saying, listen, it's nuclear capable and you don't have the technology to intercept it, and we're just going to make a point. Like the, it's not carrying any explosives, but without the explosive, it's still pretty devastating. And here it is, and you're not going to be able to do anything about it. And they did that on Kyiv, along with other other kinds of attacks on the city. And coupled with that, there was this, I think next day, Lavrov said the diplomats should leave the city, and the EU already said, you know, we're staying put. But that seems like more of a gradual escalation, you know, hit an embassy and then say, we told you so, we warned you. I haven't heard about, like, from the Russian side, any new indication that they want to fight outside of the current war zone. There have been these drones. There have been for a while now. I think every once in a while you get a report about a drone in some neighboring country that's like, here are the Russian drones already in the Western airspace. Lately, I think there were at least a couple of cases where a Ukrainian drone was hit. And I think the idea there is just, well, you know,
where was it? And it was hit by what?
I'm afraid I'm going to butcher it, but I think it was in Poland, but it was in one of the neighboring countries. So it's the country's air defense hit a drone that was not supposed to be in their airspace and turned out to be a Ukrainian drone. Yeah.
It was probably a mistake.
Because there's also a layer to this is, you know, you try to prevent the enemy's drones from being able to navigate accurately. Uh-huh. So you fuck with the signal. So you can, you know, it's not at all inconceivable that a drone just happened there by mistake. It's not entirely inconceivable that the drone was on its way to Russia through somebody else's territory, because that just seemed like a better way. But yeah. These are examples, I think, of there are drops, if you're talking about spilling out, you know, there are drops that fall onto neighboring countries, but it's not a decision to extend the war.
I mean, Russia's preference would be just to send the signal that it could spill over and then have these attacks stop. The ones deep into Russian territory, I think. I don't know. But as for the hypersonic missiles, first of all, it's a misnomer. It's not just that they're faster than the speed of sound. It's that they're, I think, like five times the speed of sound or something. And apparently they can evade existing air defense. Now, I've heard that Russia has only 10 or 12 of this specific kind of hypersonic missile they fired this time. So if they're sending a message with that, it almost has to be a nuclear message, because you can load them up with conventional arms, but, you know, 10 or 12 of them alone is not an existential threat. But I think they may have more different kinds of hypersonic missiles. I think Iran even has a hypersonic missile. I think they sent at least one of them over to Israel to make the point. So I don't know how many they have, but yeah, that's a whole thing. But I think right now what you have is some signaling between what Lavrov said and the nuclear exercises. I think Russia is saying back off. And, you know, of course, Ukraine's saying, wait a second, you invaded, you know, you feel no constraints about bombing any acre of our territory, and you started the war. But still, this has been a concern all along, that, you know, threatening the Russian territory could lead to a wider war. So we'll see. An interesting question that brings in the Iran war, and we can just touch on this briefly before going into overtime, but is this the thing you talked about, kind of the kill, like, to what extent? So in Ukraine, drone technology has favored what had been the weaker country that was more on the defensive. And the same thing happened in Iran. Like, we have more firepower than Iran by a long shot. In fact, did a whole lot more damage than they did to anybody. But the drones allowed them to do amount of damage that, you know, is close to politically unacceptable for Trump, especially to the extent that it helps them continue to close the Straits of Hormuz, which it does, the Strait of Hormuz. So a question always is, wait, is this an inherent pro-defense, pro-smaller nation bias of drones? Or is this just a temporary thing where the other powers haven't quite caught up? Because the U.S. isn't super advanced in drone technology. And that's why, folks, Taiwan, I'm sorry, do not get in a war with China over Taiwan. I'm sure they have better drone technology. I'm sure they have swarms. And by the way, the U.S. ships are staying hundreds of miles away from Iran because they're not safe, okay? This, and I don't think that's mainly about Iran's missiles. I could be wrong. I think it's more about the drones. Anyway, for now, this technology is having a seemingly somewhat systematic effect in favor of smaller nations on the offensive. Whether that's going to keep happening, I don't know. But
I think it's a technology race and strategy race. Like, the war has changed. The previous methods are not applicable anymore.
Totally.
So it's just two sides learning, figuring out the better way to use this technology and to get this technology, to get better drones, to get the materials for them. I was just listening to this podcast where the guy said, you know, there was a time in the beginning of the war where you could just go on like your run-of-mill Chinese online marketplace and get those fiber optics, you know, that are now used for drones that don't break the signal, right? They just carry this tiny little thread.
Yeah.
And it's just like nobody needed them. It was just like for the hobbyists. And now it's this point of contention.
Ukraine is saying, how those things travel 7 miles. but they do, with the cable intact.
So it's like a spider's web kind of thread hanging behind the drone.
Fiber optic. So anyway, quickly before overtime, as of a couple of days ago, they were saying a deal was like imminent. Marco Rubio's like, we may have an announcement later today, blah, blah, blah. Started to falter. And then Trump says, hey, maybe we could throw in some Arab nations signing on to the Abraham Accords. I think what that means, I can get into this more in overtime maybe, but, you know, predictably, Israel does not like the kind of deal that it's in Trump's political interest to negotiate. And they're trying to disrupt it. And he's saying, well, how about if we throw this in? And, you know, it works on paper, but I think the real world knows Saudi Arabia is not going to go, sure, we'll just totally disregard our own domestic politics and embrace Israel. Sure. I don't think so, but we'll see. Anyway, and then the U.S. attacked Iran, not a good sign, because the ceasefire had been holding pretty much, at least between the U.S. and Iran. Israel has accelerated the kinetic action, as they say, in Lebanon. And, you know, whether that's a last burst authorized by the U.S. before the deal takes effect, which some people thought for a while, or is the deal falling apart? I don't know. Anyway, maybe we'll talk about, by the time this airs in a few hours from now, maybe it'll all be clear. Maybe we'll talk about it more in overtime. But first, I'll give you a chance to say anything else you want to say, Nikita. But we're about to show you the first part of my conversation, which I had previously with Jeremy, who is going to be part of the AI discussion on Discord. Now, it's a big tent. His ideology is not like the ideology of the Discord. You know, his approach to AI, all perspectives welcome, but he'll be one of the voices. You will. Sometimes even I will.
I think we should also say that Discord is one dimension of this. What they want to do is to create an ongoing, or rather to kind of revitalize. The Discord is there and people do talk there, but we want to put more effort into it and into maintaining an ongoing conversation among the community. And Discord is not the only channel for this. It's the place to keep be updated and be a part of it. But Jeremy and I were also talking about doing meetups like Zoom calls or whatever, video calls with whoever who wants to join, with AI being the main topic, at least in the beginning. So if that sounds interesting, do go join that Discord, because that's where we're going to organize this. We're going to talk about when to best do it and what the first topic should be, etc. But it's a part of a broader initiative on trying to connect the audience members together so that they're less of an audience and more of a community.
Okay. Well, and we are all, I'm excited, and you know, it takes a lot to get me excited. It takes a veritable Discord renaissance. And have we said all we need to say about where people find our Discord?
The link is in the show notes, the link is in the video description. I should also say that I taped a conversation with Jeremy last autumn. And I'm gonna publish it today, I think, at Psychopolitica. And it's a more, yours is more real, concrete stuff happening right now, and our conversation was more speculative and cosmic, and we talked about various possibilities. Yeah.
So yeah, all through, and I will say, what you're going to see now is, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes of the Jeremy thing. Then the paywall will descend. We'll be in overtime. You'll see another 5-10 minutes of the Jeremy thing, and then soon the entire Jeremy conversation with me will be on the Non-Zero audio podcast feed. If you want to hear more, and then now back to this podcast after the Jeremy part, you and I are going to say a little more in overtime. I want to talk a little about a kind of alternative Catholic vision of AI, Catholic related mm-hmm. vision of AI that actually I get into a little in my book. I invoke a mystical Catholic theologian of the 20th century. And also we watched Blade Runner 2049. Hmm. Maybe I'll say a little about the Blade Runner franchise and premise. I don't know what else. And then maybe you can talk a little about your little Greek mystery thing.
I can do that.
I don't want to minimize it. I mean, your big Greek mystery thing. Well,
right. Why religion, religious practice. There may be also more things to say about Ukraine, like where is all this headed, which in short, I think the domestic realities in both countries are the thing to watch, the strength of the regime in both belligerents.
All right. So here comes a little Jeremy, overtime, a little more Jeremy, a little more Bob and Nikita. I don't know what else a person could ask for, but we encourage you. I think we will ask for more from you, and we'll do it right now. Smash the like button, rate and review. Think about becoming a paid subscriber, because that's how you get this highly valuable overtime content.
Mm-hmm. And comment. A good conversation in the YouTube comments would help the video, and also would just be interesting to engage in.
Yeah, and something positive, like about Bob, maybe. I mean, not that it's ever flooded with Bob negativity, and it's not, it's really not, but still, I have a very fragile ego, and my self-esteem could use a little boosting, and Nikita's too, but, you know.
I'm good.
Nikita's good.
I don't want my ego to be boosted. Let's keep it in check.
You are wise beyond your years, Nikita. Okay, here we go. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
You know, I'm doing damn good, and I'll tell you why. I've been enduring a heat wave, and for reasons I won't get into, I've been enduring it without air conditioning. But at this very moment, a cool front is moving in. I can see it. I can hear it. I've opened the windows. The rain will start descending momentarily. The wind has picked up. So I'm feeling very good about life. Let me introduce us. I've already introduced myself again, I guess, partly at least. I'm the person who's feeling relief from a heat wave. And, you know, I'm a Non-Zero newsletter proprietor, podcast, and so on. And you are Jeremy Eliasoff. You are the national leader of Pause AI Canada, which sounds important. Now you're also, I mean, not to change that perception at all, but you are also a member of the Non-Zero community. And in fact, you wound up in this role by virtue of being a member of the Non-Zero community, right? And this is, I should say, a pretty community-oriented conversation we're about to have. It's about some conversations we're going to start having on the Non-Zero platform and so on. It's also about AI, as has already been suggested. But why don't you, before we get into all that, why don't you start by telling us how you went from being a mere member of Non-Zero community, one of, I don't know, billions, I guess, or dozens, maybe, to being, well, I'm going to repeat this, the national leader of Pause AI Canada, Okay. That's like quite a catapulting. And I'm not saying my platform was critical, but, you know, didn't hurt. Anyway, how did this happen?
Yeah, it's a question I ask myself frequently. You know, it all began, well, long ago when I've had a lifelong interest in artificial intelligence since like...
Have you?
Yeah, since maybe the late 90s. Like, I was interested in the work of Daniel Dennett and sort of theoretical stuff about can computers think. And then later, like Ray Kurzweil. And I actually took a year off of my, like, I don't work in artificial intelligence. I work in computer animation. So it's somewhat technical, but not that technical. But I took a year off in 2012, 13 to study psychology and computer science at McGill at the undergraduate level with the basically the intention of studying AI, such as it is. And I was even programming some neural networks back in those days in like Scheme. Of all things. So very academic at that point. But then at some point I came across like a blog post by Wait But Why by Tim Urban, which apparently was a very influential blog post. And it, like, it's called like the AI revolution is coming or something. This is like 2015. And that's when it really got me thinking about like AGI, artificial general intelligence, artificial superintelligence. And then, you know, a few years later, the ChatGPT came along and I was just like, oh my God, it's like happening. And somewhere in that trajectory, I got associated with the rationalist community, actually via a book club on superintelligence by Nick Bostrom. And that, again, you know, movie that was, I think that book is from 2014 or something, but I think I encountered it maybe 2017. And then it was through the rationalist that I got a buddy of mine and I got kind of recruited by someone at Pause AI to start a local chapter. So we did, and that was about a year ago.
Okay, so the we should say, for people who don't know the landscape, the rationalist community is where Eliezer Yudkowsky kind of emerged from. I mean, I don't know, there's some overlapping communities. Anyway, his blog, Less Wrong, is thought of as an important part of the rationalist community, I gather. And so they were talking about AI before it was cool. And also about the possibility of doomer scenarios. You know, Eliezer is, of course, kind of doomer in chief. So that's interesting. Now, so was I wrong to say that the non-zero played a role? I was kind of thinking you had said that you saw my conversation with Holly Elmore, who's head of Pause AI US, and this was an inspiration. But if I'm wrong, go ahead, straighten me out, burst my bubble. It's fine. I can take it.
Bob, you were integral to my journey to Pause AI for sure.
Thank you. It's the least I could do. It was nothing, really.
I'm just trying to remember exactly how.
But what is the actual story?
I think I may have first heard of Pause AI through your interview with Holly Elmore, one of your interviews. So, I know by the time we were recruited, it was like a name that was familiar to me. So, definitely. And a lot of the AI kind of discourse I've come to through listening to your podcast. So, yeah, very important.
Although it sounds like you were in the game before I was, although I was writing about it a long time ago.
Didn't you do cover piece or something way back?
Well, you know, it's funny you should mention that because I forgot to mention that in my book.
Is it too late?
It is too late. The book exists. The physical copies of the book apparently exist. I haven't seen them anyway. I mean, as long as we're being self-referential, the book is called The God Test. It's about AI. People can order it now. Published in June. Well, God bless you. We need more. I was going to say we need more Americans like you, but I guess we need more Canadians like you. Longer ago than that. Okay, so that was when Deep Blue, the IBM computer, beat the world chess champion, I guess it was Garry Kasparov. Time asked me to write a thing about it. I did write a cover story, but I wound up writing it about the consciousness question rather than about AI. And one reason is because the AI thing was kind of boring to me because it was basically just brute force. It wasn't, you know, the computer wasn't very much like a human mind. And it was maybe technically AI. It could do something that normally it takes a human brain to do. But And anyway, I just occurred to me that in my book is a little occasionally autobiographical because I have had these run-ins with AI beginning in 1983 when I interviewed Jeffrey Hinton. I don't know. Have I told you that I interviewed Jeffrey Hinton?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I guess I've mentioned it. Anyway, he's now often called the godfather of AI and so on. So I started writing about it way back then and just periodically kind of checked in. I wrote about technology sometimes. And but it wasn't until ChatGPT, I guess it was 3.5, that I kind of woke up and saw that there was this new wave of AI that was going to be transformative and started writing this book. So you were onto this earlier than I was. I mean, especially if you're into neural networks, I mean, that is the paradigm that kind of prevailed. And back in 1983, when I talked to Hinton, you know, his was like a maverick movement. Like it wasn't, he was talking about neural networks, massive parallelism. It was a thing, but it was a small kind of minority within the research community. It didn't have really much to show for itself yet. But you fooled around with neural networks, it sounds like.
Yeah, in a very sort of primitive, rudimentary way. Like there were only like a few layers and they were very small. Right. They didn't do, but it was still like, it was quite fascinating to see their ability to like, do some image recognition, like just recognize what a triangle is and that sort of thing. So the principle of it was there and was intriguing, but I didn't at the time anticipate what a huge deal it was going to be.
Yeah, one of the big breakthroughs Hinton was part of, it was something called AlexNet, which just moved the ball way forward on image recognition and made a huge splash. And some people would say that's when deep learning as neural nets with a lot of layers are kind of roughly called, really, really started turning heads. A lot, actually, Canada has a lot to be proud of. Elias, the great proud. Elias Etzkever.
Proud for bringing on the end of the world.
What's
proud
that?
Proud for bringing on the end of the world.
Well, isn't he trying to now stop?
Yes,
that
no, Yashua is being very good. Yes. And so is Jeff Hinton. Like the it's true. Canada has a bizarre role as like academic authorities. And there's also like David Duvineau. I don't know if you know this guy or.
I know of him. I had the co-author, one of the co-authors of his gradual disempowerment paper, David Kruger, was on the podcast.
I used to sing in a choir with him, with David Kruger. I don't think he likes.
Really?
Yeah. I don't think he necessarily wants me to remind everyone of that. But I actually really recommend. David Davino, if you can get him as a guest, because he's really interesting. And anyway, like, but David Kruger was also in Montreal for a while. And we have this weird niche of like having a lot of the AI kind of pioneers either still here or arrived here. And I think very few of them were actually born here. But so for whatever reason, that's sort of Canada's thing. And I'm hoping that we can leverage that as some kind of to give a bit of clout in the international conversation on all this. And we can be, you know, everyone likes Canadians, right? We're diplomatic. I mean, at least that's supposedly our brand. So we can be sort of like the arbitrators and the authorities. And this is my vision anyway, in the international discussion. And also, you know, with Carney's recent, our prime minister's recent statements at Davos saying that we want to be like middle power leaders. So it's all very, you know, aspirational, but what else can we do? Like that, this is a big problem with anyone, even anyone in the States, anyone who's concerned about this, like is a lot of us are really frustrated at what we can do. Like things are just barreling ahead and it's even worse if you don't happen to live in San Francisco. So, you know, I'm just sort of, I don't want to say grasping at straws, but trying to come up with some ideas of what I can do and what just any of us can do to try to steer this course.
Okay, so this is a good time to elaborate on what I was saying about some conversations we're going to have within the community. So we have a Discord, a non-zero Discord thing. I mean, don't ask me to say more than that because I am this far from being a Discord virgin. I did show up once and like say hello world or something, but I'm not that familiar with it but I kind of get the basic idea, and I'm going to become more familiar with it. And we are going to much more systematically foster conversation about AI on the Discord. You're going to play a role in that, Jeremy. I'm going to play a role. Nikita Petrov, well-known member of the Non-Zero team and of the Psychopolitica newsletter, is going to play a role, and maybe others on the team will weigh in. But I want to say first off, the conversation on the Discord, and I really encourage people to check it out. I think the link to the Discord is in any recent YouTube video of ours on the Non-Zero channel. It'll be in the post on the Non-Zero site associated with this conversation, or with a conversation I just will have had with Nikita by the time this posts, and in which this will be embedded. It's getting kind of complicated, I know. But anyway, I encourage people to check out the Discord. And I want to say, you know, again, it's a big tent. You have your views, and I want to explore those more. I have my views, but this is for everyone, you know, ranging from safety hawks to safety fanatics to accelerationists who think all the safety people are crazy. And it won't just be about kind of AI policy and so on. I mean, it can also be a place where people talk about how they're using AI, what they don't like about the way it's affecting their lives, what they do like about the way it's affecting their lives, kind of any and all things. And so people should show up and check it out.